course, Noma.
Sangbijale.
No matter how you say it, it's a great time to awaken the Force. In Tomorrowland, come face to face with some favorite Star Wars characters. And even join in a dogfight between X-Wing and TIE Fighters on Hyperspace Mountain. SoCal residents can get 2 days for $149. Visit one park per day. Tap the banner for details as Star Wars awakens at Disneyland Resort. Subject to blockout dates, restrictions, and change without notice.
Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. This is the first of live shows again now that I finished my book manuscript. This is syndicated columnist Amy Elkon. This is Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. Sometimes we can be stupid frugal. And when I say we, I mean I. I've mentioned in my column and on this show that I have attention deficit disorder, which I was diagnosed with about 15 years ago. I take medication for this. And I describe it for people who don't have it as like trying to think while being attacked by a flock of crows. So this prescription helps, and I also use music while I write on Pandora to help me kind of stay in my work. But I'm from the Midwest, I was raised to be frugal, so I would listen to free Pandora, which meant that I would have my work interrupted, my precious flow interrupted by a commercial every 7 minutes or so. So, and I somehow gave them the impression that I'm Spanish speaking, so they'd start yelling at me in Spanish about Trader Joe's. This was insane. So, and I spend my days reading about human cognitive biases, so I should have known better. But it was only after I turned in my manuscript, after a brutal 19-hour writing day one Sunday, and read the rest of the book by my guest tonight, Dr. Elizabeth Dunn, that I realized what an idiot I'd been. Pandora is $3 a month, $36 a year, $3 a month. So I pay for it now, which means it costs me $3 a month to not scowl with annoyance and be pulled out of whatever I'm doing every 7 minutes. So now, this is not, I'm not alone. It turns out that money and our fears and misconceptions about spending and saving lead us all to make a lot of mistakes. And helping you realize what they are and smarter ways of spending and saving is the subject of tonight's show with my guest, Dr. Elizabeth Dunn. She's a psychologist and researcher, and her book, co-authored with Dr. Michael Norton, is terrific, and it's called Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. So stick with us. Be prepared to be both entertained and to learn a lot about how you can spend and save in ways that not only make you happier, but may even provide lasting happiness. So hello, Liz.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Amy.
Thanks. And I love your book because it's research-based, but you also, like me, reveal your foibles. And you did. You started out researching how to spend money once you started earning some money.
I did. So I got my first real job in my mid-20s and suddenly found myself making a real adult income. So having just gotten a PhD and having conducted research on happiness in graduate school, I wondered how I could use that money to make myself happier, how I could use this actual grown-up income to be happy. And I was surprised to discover at the time that there wasn't much research on this topic.
That's kind of amazing because there's a lot of research now on happiness, but and we don't really think about this as something that we need to study. So people have financial advisors to increase the amount of money they have, but you say when it comes to spending money, people are just, they're content to rely on their hunches about what will make them happy. And you say that there's actually little reason to assume that our human intuition provides a very good guide.
Exactly. So a great deal of research suggests that as humans, we have a pretty hard time knowing the reasons for our feelings and behavior in general, and happiness is really no exception. Figuring out what exactly makes you happy, what kind of purchases deliver lasting happiness, is actually a pretty hard problem, and luckily it is the kind of problem that we can solve with experiments and lots of data and at least provide people with some useful insight. Just like financial advisors can provide people with some insight about how to make more money, we try to provide people with some insight about how to have happier money.
Yeah, I think this is very, very interesting. And also, I love that you looked at it the way you did. You said just because money often fails to buy happiness, does that mean that it can't? And you run around and your grad students run around doling out cash to strangers to see what makes them happier when they spend money.
Exactly. In one of the first studies we ever conducted in this line of work, we actually sent research assistants out on campus with a big stack of bills and had them literally go up to people, hand them money, and tell them to spend it in different ways by the end of the day so we could look at experimentally what made people happy, what spending choices led people to be happier by the end of the day.
And one of them wasn't mugging your research assistants because you're in Canada and you guys don't have muggers, right?
Right. There was no reported mugging.
So you in your book, Happy Money, focus on different ways that you can spend your money and different mistakes we make. And I love chapter one. And you talk about, you start it with, give an example, the person has $200,000. And you say they could spend this upgrading to a Tudor-style home on a leafy street in the suburbs. This is what my parents would say to spend it on. But they could also book a ticket for a six-minute space flight on the Virgin Galactic. And so when people are presented with that choice, what happens?
Well, I think most sensible, sane people would say you should buy a nice home rather than buying a ticket to outer space. I mean, that's pretty obvious, at least on the surface. What's fascinating, though, is the happiness research points to exactly the opposite conclusion. Research suggests that moving to a newer, nicer home doesn't actually do much for our happiness, whereas having amazing life experiences can actually make a difference for our well-being.
And that's the title of this chapter, Buy Experiences. And I love this because I rent, so it doesn't make me feel so bad. Because here in L.A., you can't really get a doghouse in Compton unless you have $1 million. So, you know, it's sort of untenable, but I find that, you know, I have a little house, and I've been to Paris. You talk about this comparison as a way to feel good about what you have, and there they have tiny little spaces and tiny little bathrooms, and I've become glad that I just have a roof over my head and a refrigerator and a little car, and there's some food in the refrigerator. These smaller things, if you're not comparing to people who are living in Beverly Hills mansions.
Exactly, and so if you're thinking about, you know, living in a really, really problematic house. So, for example, there's research showing that living in a home in Mexico with a cement floor rather than a mud floor does make a difference for both mother's happiness and children's well-being. But most of us are not choosing, fortunately, between a mud home, a floor with a made of mud versus a floor made of cement. Often the choice is more like, oh, you know, do I want maple hardwood or bamboo or wall-to-wall carpeting? And when we're making those choices between, you know, options that are all reasonably good on this sort of scale of human experience, it just doesn't make that big a difference. So it's better to save a little bit of money and buy, like, not the fanciest hardwood ever, for example, and use that money to buy experiences.
And actually, just before we get to experiences a little more, you did a study that showed this really well about the happiness of Harvard students who get assigned by this random lottery, either prime real estate really near campus or some kind of hovel really far away. And what did you find when you did this study?
Well, it was interesting. When I was an undergraduate at Harvard, I worked with Dan Gilbert, and I convinced him that we really needed to do this study because students were being randomly assigned to live in houses that varied a lot in terms of their quality, which gave us a really neat opportunity to study what happens when people get assigned purely by chance to live in, you know, a centrally located beautiful house or one certainly doesn't have a mud floor. It's fine. But it's further away and, you know, not as beautiful. It will never be on the cover of a Harvard brochure. Does this make a difference? And what we found by tracking these students over time was that people thought, these Harvard students thought that the quality of their house would have a big impact on their happiness. What we found, however, was that the physical qualities of the houses, things like their location, made no difference at all for students' overall happiness. What did matter, interestingly, though, was the quality of their relationships with their roommates. So students that were living in a house where they really liked their roommates, where they felt a strong sense of community, they were happier. So we could see differences in happiness as a function of the kinds of things that we measured. But what didn't matter was things like the size of their rooms and the actual location of the house.
Yeah, that's so interesting because we really think that matters, central location. And you show this throughout your book that community really matters. I saw this last night. I had two friends. We went over to one friend's house, brought some wine, brought some cheese. And it was one of the best evenings. We spent 4 hours. We spent like each, you know, $10 or something like that because she gave me my salami to take home. And, you know, and it was this fantastic evening because of the company, because we were communing.
Exactly. And that's turns out to be one of the reasons why experiences are often better than material things, is that our experiences often bring us closer to other people. So sometimes, you know, we don't have to spend any money at all. Often, though, when you think about it, even relatively inexpensive experiences like the one you're describing do involve some, you know, financial cost, however low. But I would argue that's money very well spent.
Yeah, it really, I agree with you. And actually, you talk about a woman who spent quite a bit of money. This very moving story you tell, to get back to the Virgin Galactic, a woman who's a nuclear engineer, she dreamed of being an astronaut. She and her husband, who's also a nuclear engineer, talked about buying two tickets. But, you know, like most of us, I was raised to be frugal. They were raised to be frugal. They thought, you know, we can't spend $200,000. But then something happened.
Tragically, her husband passed away at a very young age, and there she was, left with the life insurance money, and, you know, found herself, I guess, suddenly relatively wealthy, but, of course, having lost her husband. And for quite a while, she just put the money away and grieved, as most of us probably would. But eventually, she said to herself, okay, what am I going to do with this money? And, you know, as she put it, her husband's death reminded her that life is short and fragile, and you can't keep putting off amazing experiences. So what she did was to take that life insurance money and use it to purchase a ticket to outer space for herself on Virgin Galactic. And so having spoken with her, that trip, which is still upcoming, is something that really, like, motivates her and gets her excited on a day-to-day basis. And obviously nothing could ever replace her husband, but this actually provides a way of honoring her his memory while also, you know, providing her with this truly incredible experience.
I thought that was so incredible, but you do emphasize in here that you don't have to spend a pile of money, that people, you say that people can play a video game or listen to a song and get more pleasure out of that than spending the same money on a material thing.
Yeah, so the interesting finding in this area of research is that for purchases both, you know, huge and rather mundane, experiences seem to win the day. So in one experiment, people were given the opportunity to buy something worth as little as $3. And when they bought an experience, like the opportunity to listen to a song or play a video game, they actually got more happiness and surprisingly more lasting happiness than when they got to buy a material thing, some kind of trinket.
It is so amazing. And so about that $200,000 space ride, you know, it would be imprudent for a lot of people to take that $200,000 and go to space. But you have this exercise you ask people to try, to think of purchases they've made with a goal of increasing their happiness, and you have them consider the material purchase and then a purchase that gave them life experience, like a trip, a concert, or a special meal. And what do you find when people do this little test?
What we see is that most people report deriving greater happiness from that experiential purchase as opposed to the material purchase. So, you know, even if you're not somebody who's contemplating a trip to space, even your more sort of typical experiences like going out for dinner are likely to provide a bigger kind of happiness hit than common material purchases like a new bag, pair of shoes, the latest smartphone.
And we want those things, but you talk about something I've talked about on my shows with Sonia Lubomirsky, this that we adapt to things very quickly, both positive and negative experiences. So you get the new shoes and they're fabulous and they make a difference for, you know, whatever time. And then quickly we get used to having those shoes and they're not that happiness producing anymore.
Yeah, it's really one of the biggest barriers to altering people's happiness is this profound capacity to adapt to whatever we've got. Now, we wouldn't want to give this up. So if someone offered you a pill that would make this ability disappear, I would recommend you turn down that pill. It's a very useful capacity that we humans have that we can get used to whatever's going on in our lives. No matter, you know, like Marcia, when she lost her husband so tragically, she was devastated, but she eventually got used to the situation and was able to move forward. So, you know, it's true for bad events that when we encounter even really terrible events in our lives, we're eventually able to bounce back at least somewhere close to reaching at least somewhere near our prior levels of happiness. The flip side, though, is that when something really great happens, like we get this amazing raise at work or we move into a big, beautiful new home that just seems stunning to us, we get used to it. It just becomes the sort of circumstances of our lives and may cease to have a really powerful impact on our day-to-day happiness.
It's so amazing. We really don't believe that. We think that the new house, I just need to get that house. You see people, you know, saving all their lives for that, and they don't realize that, which is why I think your book is so important, and I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is psychologist Dr. Elizabeth Dunn, discussing the book she co-authored with Dr. Michael Norton called Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. And it really is good. It's also, I love it, it's 157 pages long and very entertaining, which I appreciate because, you know, I have to read the whole book and everything. So anyway. So it's something I found, there are a lot of little bits of information. This is one that I was interested in. People who spend more of their money on leisure report significantly greater satisfaction with their lives. So we should maybe not work all weekend?
Right. So it's perhaps a bit ironic that I'm in my office right now in this interview. But certainly, at least with the leisure time that we have, we can sometimes make the most of it by being willing to, you know, buy that pair of skis or that opportunity to take a vacation so that we can really suck the potential happiness out of life by engaging in these cool experiences.
And actually, you say that even tough experiences, they look more positive to us in hindsight, or very positive. The awful things that happen on a camping trip, you get a leech on your leg, that turns into sort of a good experience in the future.
Exactly. So part of the magic of the human mind is that the mind allows us to sort of reframe, reconstrue, rethink our past experiences till we see them in a relatively rosy light. So, for example, many of us have been on vacations that maybe didn't go quite perfectly. I can certainly think of a few. And so when we go on vacations, we may in the moment be, you know, a little disappointed or something, but eventually our minds are likely to remember the best bits, and the parts that didn't go so well may actually become the really funny story that we tell and retell after we've gotten home.
And you write about what memories do for us. You write about the film The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Jim Carrey, Kate Winslet, they play a couple who's broken up, and they hire this company to remove all traces of each other from their memories. And you say that there's a problem with this, that losing their memories means losing themselves.
Right. So our memories really make us who we are. And, in fact, when people are asked to think about their past material purchases and their past experiential purchases, they tend to report that their experiential purchases are much more closely related to how they see themselves. And interestingly, in one study that seems like it was built on that movie, people were asked to imagine that they could just go back in time and change things a little bit so that they would no longer have had this past purchase. when people are asked to engage in that sort of bizarre thought exercise with regard to an experience, imagine that they never had it and never happened, they're really unwilling to accept that trade-off. Whereas with a material thing, people are more willing to have, say, lived their lives without that, like, last BlackBerry or something. Whereas giving up, like, that trip to Italy that you took, you know, after you graduated from college with your best friend, something that people see as really central to who they are and something that they couldn't possibly imagine having lost.
Well, do people want to give up negative things that happen to them, or do they see them as sort of self-building, that, you know, that which does not kill us makes us stronger kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, certainly to some extent, there are people who actually seek out what might be considered by many of us rather unpleasant experiences, because those experiences can build what researchers have termed the experiential CV. So we sort of build up this CV of, like, unusual, unique, weird experiences. And that helps to explain why people want to do things like go stay in a hotel made entirely of ice.
You also, talked about this thing called Tough Mudder, M-U-D-D-E-R, that people love to do, where they go through something that seems like goose poop, and they just love it. They wear these orange headbands, and this is one of their priceless memories from their lives, this Tough Mudder event that's some kind of horrible triathlon.
I am actually thinking about doing a Tough Mudder event. To me, it sounds really fun. To my co-author, Mike Norton, it seems like the worst idea in the world. But it's actually become this very successful business, and it's really quite remarkable because Tough Mudder gets people to pay a fair bit of money to participate in these events that involve, for example, crawling through pits of icy mud and crossing along handbars that are greased in butter over, you know, an icy cold pit of water. People will pay money to engage in these activities, and in fact, it's become an extremely successful business, in part by really maximizing that social quality of experiences. So whereas many, for example, triathlons are really based on, you know, your own performance time and your own ability and your own score and so forth, Tough Mudder has really capitalized on the social value of experiences by, for example, creating obstacles that no one person can get across on their own, such that people have to work together in order to surmount the challenge. And in doing so and having to sort of come together with other people, Tough Mudder participants report that this experience becomes something that's just really foundational and important to them.
That's so amazing. It's sort of like when you get a flat tire, and we were talking about how after the fact that you can look back on it, it becomes a source of amusement, and how you dealt with it with the other person, that all becomes sort of part B of your experience, whereas if you buy a new handbag, there is no part B.
Right, right. And I mean, certainly the best, you know, the best experiences are ones that are genuinely positive and that our minds really don't have to do too much work to improve. But the sort of nice kind of cushion for buying experiences, I guess, is that even when they don't turn out perfectly, in those cases, we can kind of find the silver lining.
And now you had some good advice. There are purchases that we make that fall somewhere between experience and material things. So music would be one of these. And you suggest trying to see these things through the lens of them being experiential purchases. So how would that work with music, for example?
Right. So many, many purchases you can kind of think of more as an experience or more of as a material thing. So, for example, at least back in the day, it's perhaps music is moving more toward the experiential category, I would say, overall. But certainly you can still buy, you know, a boxed set of CDs, some special collection, and think about it really as a material good, as something that you would, you know, place on your shelf and be proud to show to friends and so forth, really thinking about it as sort of that, like, physical object. In contrast, the way to be happier is actually to think of that same exact purchase very much in terms of its experiential quality. So focus on the feelings that you have when you listen to the music, the experience of listening to that music, and you're likely to be more satisfied with the purchase. I spoke with someone the other day who said she even thinks of shoes as being potentially an experiential purchase. And really almost anything, I mean, I would personally categorize shoes pretty squarely in the material purchase category. That said, you know, if with enough mental work, we can kind of rethink many of our purchases and really think about them as in terms of the experiences those purchases deliver rather than in terms of their more physical material component.
Well, actually, when you say that, I can see if you're an extrovert and you're willing to go out and talk to people, if you get really, really interesting shoes or people who wear eccentric clothes, people will talk to you about those shoes. So you can see them as a way to start conversations, which you can if you just wear a pair of floor shines or something like that. But, I mean, I think there are ways to even make those purchases that are just these inanimate objects that we wear to do what you're saying, to turn them into experiences. So you have this great next chapter. It's about, you title it, Make It a Treat. And you start out with a great quote from Sarah Silverman: "Fart jokes make me happier than just about anything in the universe. And for that reason, I'm terrified by the idea that someday I might have had enough of them. If they are a genuine treat and a surprise, they are the surest way to send me into tear-soaked convulsions of laughter." So that's Sarah Silverman. So tell us what you make of what you call Silverman's mantra, make it a treat.
Well, so, you know, all this talk of fart jokes and pornography doesn't sound like the foundation for good science. But in fact, I think the research reveals that Sarah Silverman is really onto something. So her core idea here, although she expresses it in kind of classic comedian terms, is that, you know, when we love something, if we have it all the time, we're going to just get used to it, and then we're going to not be able to get quite as much pleasure from it. So there's actually a considerable body of rigorous research documenting what we like to call Silverman's mantra, that what you really should do is turn your favorite things back into treats, sort of engage in a little bit of self-denial so that you can really enjoy what you've got.
This is so interesting, and you give an example, actually, one of the examples you give is that exposure diminishes the impact of something. That's not always a bad thing. You got your corgi sprayed by a skunk, and so when you were immersed in the skunk smell, you stopped smelling it, so it apparently works both ways.
Right. So once again, you know, overall, the human happiness system works well, right? Like, something bad happens to us, like, for example, when my dog got coated in skunk spray. At first, it smelled, like, unbearably horrible to me, but I had to do something about it. I had to bathe him. So eventually, it became, you know, totally bearable to me, almost too bearable because I didn't realize that I still smelled horrible to everybody. But overall, this is a good thing for humans, that we can get used to all of these bad things, from being sprayed by a skunk to, you know, living in a cramped apartment with five roommates, whatever. Now, the problem comes in again when we try to think about getting happier. So, if we indulge in our favorite things all of the time, we're likely to get used to those things as well. And because the human happiness system is so attuned to change, when we just keep having the same enjoyable things all the time, they cease to deliver the same kind of boost for our enjoyment that they once did.
And in fact, I have to say, for anyone who's just tuned in, first of all, I'm talking with Dr. Elizabeth Dunn, author with Dr. Michael Norton of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, which is a very practical book, which I love. You are not somebody who says, oh, don't spend any money. You know, you're a woman who wrote about the $200,000 6-minute space ride as a, you know, smart thing to do through your buy experiences chapter as a way to be happy. But you also write about how wealth can interfere with the proclivity to savor things. And you mentioned Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and how all the wealthy kids got piles of chocolate, and Charlie got just one chocolate bar a year on his birthday, and he loved that chocolate bar and ate it in a way, this sort of loving way, that none of those kids who were wealthy and got all the chocolate dealt with theirs.
Exactly. So there's this part of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory that I just love, where it explains how he would peel back a tiny bit of the paper wrapping at one corner to expose a tiny bit of chocolate, and then he would take a tiny nibble, just enough to allow this lovely sweet paste to spread out slowly over his tongue. And I think that sort of tiny nibble that we let spread out slowly over our tongues is perhaps missing sometimes in our modern lives, where we do have access to, you know, many pleasurable things. Things like chocolate, you know, you can walk into any convenience store and buy a ton of chocolate for less than $5. And so when we have plenty of what we want right there in front of us, it's easy to just kind of wolf it down without really pausing to think about it. And in fact, in one experiment, we actually tried to kind of understand this Charlie Bucket phenomenon by exposing some people to a photograph of a big stack of money and then offering them some chocolate. And what we found was that when people had just seen a photograph of a big stack of money, they actually ate this piece of chocolate faster and they enjoyed it less. They didn't take the time to really savor it. And, you know, this seems pretty bizarre. Why would seeing a bunch of money lead you to eat chocolate faster and not enjoy it as much? And the idea here is that just being exposed to reminders of money makes us feel like we can get whatever we want whenever we want it. And in fact, we also find that wealthier individuals are less likely to report savoring everyday pleasures.
That is so interesting. But I have actually seen that in my own life. I eat a very low-carb diet, and I allow myself dessert about once every week or week and a half. I get a teeny little chocolate bar. And I love this chocolate bar. I taste the chocolate, like you're saying, like Charlie Bucket, in a way I never did before when I'd have a brownie one day and ice cream the next, and I was 300 pounds, not kidding. But it really did make a difference. It's so exciting now to have chocolate, where before it was just like, if it's Tuesday, it must be a chocolate bar.
Right, and I think many people perhaps, because they're, you know, trying to cut back on sweets or trying to cut back on alcohol, many people recognize this at some level when it comes to food and drink, but we would argue it applies much more broadly, even to purchases like cars. Having unfettered access to something really nice all the time can actually get in the way of our ability to enjoy it.
Oh, I loved your stuff on cars. That was so interesting. You said that making driving a treat seems to make people happier, and that when researchers asked people the last time they had driven their car just for fun, what happened when they asked them that?
Well, when people, so the sort of fascinating background finding here is that when researchers look at the how the value of people's cars relates to how much they enjoy driving, shockingly, the value of people's car has no bearing whatsoever on how much they enjoy driving their cars. When researchers are looking at, you know, your last episode of driving, so for example, if people are asked, you know, how much did you enjoy your commute to work today, you'd think the Lexus drivers might have enjoyed the, you know, drive to work a little bit more than, say, I don't want to pick on any one car, but let's say just a basic Ford Escort. Interestingly, though, that doesn't turn out to be the case. So Lexus drivers don't enjoy their drive to work any more than, say, Ford Escort drivers. But the one exception there is when people make driving a treat. So when people actually go out on a joyride, then suddenly having that beautiful Lexus or the convertible BMW, that does provide more pleasure than just driving a basic Ford Escort. But we have to make driving a treat. We have to be doing this for the pleasure of driving, which it turns out people do with, you know, vanishing irregularity. Like, this hardly ever happens. The researchers had to conduct a special study just to look at these joyrides because they hardly ever were reported in people's daily life. What happens in daily life is, you know, I'm driving to get to work, or I'm rushing to pick up my kid from daycare, or, you know, grab a rotisserie chicken at the grocery store. And what I'm doing is I'm paying attention to the, like, annoying slow driver who is in front of me, slowing me down and thinking, oh, God, there's not going to be any chickens left by the time I get to the grocery store. That's what's driving my feelings on a day-to-day basis, rather than the amazing features of my, you know, BMW that really stood out to me when I did my test drive.
Just that term that you use, which I don't think people use so much anymore, probably because people don't drive this way, but joyride. To do that, that is such a great idea. It just go drive along the coast. Just do something that doesn't have a destination with panic behind it.
Exactly. A friend of mine had really cute little sports car, and he would leave it in his garage uninsured most of the time. But then on special days, you know, when he and his girlfriend wanted to drive up the coast or do something fun, they would insure it. And then having this sports car made a real difference. It was really fun. It was something they genuinely enjoyed. Now, however, he's actually had to insure the car full time, and now he just thinks of driving as kind of contained road rage.
He must live in Los Angeles. Now, feeling and expressing gratitude in the happiness research literature is a way to become substantially happier, and you know that this ties in with spending as well.
Right. So, you know, taking the time to be really grateful for what we've got is beneficial in terms of happiness. And so, you know, taking the time to really appreciate what we've already got and maybe slow down those new purchases can make a difference for our happiness.
And now we talked about giving up chocolate for, you know, as an everyday thing, having it as a treat. But you also say that we can take self-denial too far. And you talk about people who have stripped their lives of possessions, thinking they'll be happier, and that there's little rigorous evidence that emptying your life like that results in some zen-like state of pure bliss.
Right. I mean, I've seen so many, like, magazine articles that sort of laud these people who have given up all of their worldly possessions or, you know, have started buying only one item of clothing a year or something. And I think it's possible to take self-denial too far. On the one hand, you know, we are arguing that having your favorite things a little bit less often can make them more enjoyable. On the other hand, we are happiness researchers. Our goal here is not just to, you know, live as simply as humanly possible. And, you know, in fact, in doing the research for this book, I was kind of surprised to discover that there's really no good evidence that living the super simple life somehow makes you magically happier. What we're saying then is not, you know, that you should never have things like chocolate or comfortable clothes or whatever. You can have that stuff, but just have it a little bit less often so that you really appreciate those treats when you have them.
So, so interesting, all this stuff. I want to touch on a few more things from this chapter, one of which, I love this, the idea that when we know something won't last forever, we're more likely to savor it. And you say this explains why people don't visit famous landmarks in their hometown. And it seems that expiration dates of some kind of thing we should do help. Like if Big Ben's going to close for the summer, you know, for it to be fixed, that maybe that would induce more people to visit.
Exactly. So surprisingly, although London is one of the most visited cities in the world by tourists, most residents of London have never actually taken the time to visit Big Ben. And think about that in your own hometown. You know, it's so many of us just don't bother. And surprisingly, the reason many of us won't visit a hometown landmark is just that it's always there. Because that opportunity is always available, I may never actually take it.
That's so interesting. It makes me want to visit Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, which I've never been to. No, I read what you said about that watching commercials adds to enjoyment of television. I might visit the theater. I'm not sure I'm going to do that, but apparently it does, that an interruption in some pleasurable act makes it more pleasurable.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, one of the most counterintuitive ideas that we discuss in our book, that commercials could actually make an experience better. And it's not because commercials are awesome. They're not. They're less good than the television show we're watching, if we're watching even a halfway decent program. But commercials interrupt the experience and therefore can kind of renew our capacity for pleasure, can make us kind of reset our pleasurometers so that we can really go, oh, yeah, the show is great once again. Now, that said, there are some limits on this effect. So it's particularly the case for pleasurable experiences, pleasurable TV shows that are enjoyable but somewhat monotonous. So, you know, some of the modern TV shows, like, for example, Homeland, have gotten around this problem of adaptation by doing these very quick cuts, by having sudden changes that sort of reset us automatically. But other shows are just sort of more pleasant and meandering. Like, let's say you're watching a nature documentary, and it's really beautiful. It's showing you all of these gorgeous scenes of planet Earth. It's wonderful, but we sort of get lulled into this state where we're no longer, you know, necessarily stunned by the next beautiful image of a fish that pops up. And so having that little break can make us, you know, see the next clownfish and go, oh, wow, that's really cool, in a way that we can't when we've just been kind of, when the fish have just been paraded in front of us continuously.
So, so interesting. I'm going to try this, even though I sort of don't really want to do that, because I listen to, I see exciting shows. But I want to move on. You have other advice on how to have your money make you happier is to buy time. And I love this. You write about these people. A couple, the wife's sister describes with, they're slobs. But these people are slobs with Roombas and a scuba, which is that thing that washes and scrubs and squeezes your floor. You just put a battery in it. So why is it important to have these sort of time-saving devices? They cost, they're like $200, but should people buy those to be happier?
Well, so it depends. So I don't think that, you know, everyone listening to this show should run out and buy a, you know, robot vacuum cleaner in the search for lasting happiness. However, if you happen to be somebody like me or somebody like Kathleen, who we discussed in the book, who just despises vacuum cleaning. Like for me, you know, vacuuming is one of those things that can be on my to-do list for like a month, and it's just never the thing that I want to do or am motivated to do. And just the thought of doing it, you know, fills me with dread. So if that's the case for you, then outsourcing that task to another human being or perhaps a robot can actually be a really good source of happiness, because it changes the way you spend the minutes and days of your life. And the way we spend, you know, our minutes and our days is what's really the most central to happiness.
Yeah, and you noted, too, that wealthier people who have money to alleviate some of the problems of life actually often spend their time in stressful ways. They're going to a mall, there's traffic, there's stress. They're not doing things that would make them happier through, you know, not being in these stressful situations.
Yeah, this was to me one of the most surprising findings that we came across in doing the research for this book, that wealthier people do not spend their time in happier ways on a day-to-day basis. So wealthy people have this opportunity for happiness in that they can potentially use their money to get rid of everything in life that they don't like. Well, okay, maybe not everything. You can't get rid of, you know, family members you don't like with money, and you shouldn't. But many things in life, like vacuuming, we can simply make disappear with the magic of money. And yet, amazingly, wealthier people do not use their money in happier ways on a typical day.
You know, it's amazing. Also, Martin Seligman, who is one of the fathers of positive psychology, he writes in his book, oh, shoot, I'm going to forget the title. I have it here somewhere. But he writes about standing in line for 45 minutes at the post office when stamps went up for a penny. He did this huge military contract. I think, like, you know what, if you put 90 cents on a letter instead of 46, I mean, isn't your 45 minutes worth more than that? It's so incredible how even some of the people we respect the most for their thinking do these things. We all do, how we waste our time when we don't realize that we should, you know, that the trade-off is not worth it.
Right. I mean, I know very smart people who will drive out of their way to save a couple cents a gallon on gas. And when you look at the time-money trade-off, it just doesn't make a lot of sense, because how we're spending our time is just so critical for our happiness that, you know, if we can trade a few cents to not have to spend more time in the car, it's probably worthwhile for our well-being.
So we have a question. Ask her about cheapskates. So I don't know if that's enough information, but do you have anything to say about cheapskates?
Certainly there are important individual differences in the extent to which people feel comfortable spending money. I think, you know, and this in fact can create some challenges in the context of marriage when, for example, one person is a cheapskate and one person perhaps is at the opposite end of the spectrum. I think our advice can actually be useful for cheapskates because, you know, if you're somebody who has a hard time letting go of money, I think applying these principles is useful because it can kind of free you to say, you know what, I'm going to spend a little bit more money on this, item or expenditure because it actually is going to make a difference for my happiness. So, for example, I don't like to call my husband a cheapskate, but somebody could reasonably apply that term to him. but he, I think I've been successful in persuading him that when it comes to changing the way we use our time, it's worth kind of breaking through those natural cheapskate inclinations. And, you know, you can feel okay about shelling out a little more money when it's going to make a real difference for your time.
Yeah, that's really... It's really important, I think, to see the things you point out in your book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, and I'm talking with Dr. Elizabeth Dunn about this wonderful book. You really show rational, very sensible reasons why we should spend in these ways you suggest, and one of the things you talked about that I think a lot of people deal with in the workplace is what you call the illusion of busyness for people on the job. So talk about this and what seems to be a better approach.
Well, one fascinating thing that we came across in our research for this book is that, there's this very well-known assumption, I mean, I held it, that we are getting busier, that we're busier now than we used to be, or that, you know, people today are busier than in previous generations. What's striking is that the very best data, there is data on this topic, and in fact, it turns out that this is a myth. The best data suggests that we haven't gotten busier. If anything, we have more free time than people did in previous generations. But many of us feel quite rushed. We score low in what's called time affluence, so we feel that we don't have enough free time during our days. Because we haven't necessarily really gotten busier, there's room to kind of get rid of this illusion and recognize, you know, actually, people today do have some free time. It's just we don't necessarily appreciate all the little bits of free time that we've perhaps built into our day. So the time we spend, you know, going to Starbucks and chatting with someone we bump into there, the time that we spend, you know, texting friends, all of these little bits of free time in our days, we may not recognize how much time we're actually spending on them.
That's very interesting. And if you log them, if you actually did a list of how you spend your time, which is actually good advice if you're late for things because then it tells you how much time you need to get there, but that you would actually see that you do have free time. Your life isn't drudgery. It's that's so interesting. And just even recognizing, like you're saying, I think it's very important. And also, you give us advice. It's something I found. The more I have to do, the more productive I am. It's like I get in responsibility head. And you say, actually, the research shows this too, that constraining your time constraints, can be a helpful tactic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, you know, having unlimited everything isn't necessarily good for our happiness. And I certainly find that giving myself some time constraints can be useful. And what's interesting, too, is that when we recognize that we do have some free time, that, you know, not every moment of time we need to spend working and earning money, that can kind of free us up to engage in activities like volunteering, where we actually give our time away. It turns out research shows that engaging in volunteer work is actually one of the best things that we can do for our happiness. So ironically, as many of us are trying to turn our time into more money, one of the best things we can do with our time is actually to give it away for free.
Yeah, that is so interesting. You have a great chapter on that. I love the title, Invest in Others. You know, and you have this experiment where you gave people $5 to spend either on a gift for themselves or any of their expenses or on a gift for somebody else or a donation to charity. And so what happened when you did that?
Well, we sent people off with their money and asked them to spend it during the day, either telling them to spend it on themselves or to spend on somebody else. And then we called them at the end of the day and just asked them a whole bunch of questions, including how happy they were feeling. And as it turned out, people who had been assigned to spend the money on somebody else felt significantly happier at the end of the day compared to people who had been assigned to spend the money on themselves. This is kind of surprising. I think most of us feel like, okay, it would be awesome if somebody walked up to me in the morning and handed me a $20 bill. It might be a bit of a downer if they told me I had to use it to benefit somebody else rather than myself. But in fact, that's probably the best thing that could happen is if someone walks up to you and gives you some money and gives you the opportunity to use it to benefit somebody else.
So in another one of your studies, you had a student hand out $10 Starbucks gift cards. Now, some were told to use this gift card to take somebody else out for coffee at Starbucks, and others had to give the card away and not accompany the person. So who in this was happiest, the person who got to take somebody out with it or the person who had to give it away and say, go have some coffee?
So people were happier when they not only treated a friend to Starbucks, but actually took the time to go to Starbucks with that person. So what this tells us is that, you know, if we're going to spend money on somebody we care about perhaps, we should spend time with that person too. If you're going to buy a soccer ball for your nephew, for his birthday, rather than just, you know, wrapping it up and giving it to him, you should probably take the time to, like, go to the park and kick it around with him. You'll actually get a much bigger happiness boost from kind of combining that financial expenditure with spending some time.
I love this. It's such great advice. Now, here's a question. Can you put a number on it? How much money do we need to spend on others or give away for it to make a difference in our happiness? Can you spend $5? 50 cents, 25 cents, doesn't have to be $10,000 you give to a charity. What is the ratio in terms of our happiness?
Mm-hmm. There doesn't seem to be a magic number in the research that we've conducted. What we've been startled to find is how even small changes in the way we spend our money can make a difference when it comes to when we use that money to benefit somebody else. Even a small amount of money can make a real difference. So, you know, I think many people hear this advice initially, this idea that we should invest in others and think, okay, well, that's great. I'll do that someday when I have more money. But in fact, I think this is a small change we can make in our spending habits right away, even those of us who might be struggling a bit financially. So, you know, when we first conducted this research, we did it with participants in Canada and the United States, most of whom probably were living reasonably comfortable lives. And we wondered, would this warm glow of giving that we'd observed in Canada and the United States, would it extend to countries like Uganda and South Africa, where many people are actually struggling to meet their own basic needs? To our surprise, so actually my husband was doing some volunteer work in Uganda, and he amazingly managed to round up some local collaborators for me who helped our research team conduct research there. What was amazing is that the kinds of spending experiences people told us about there were just so strikingly different. So we asked people in both Canada and Uganda to look back on a time that they'd spent some of their own money on themselves or somebody else and really vividly recall that experience and tell us about how it made them feel. Now, the kinds of experiences that people described just couldn't have been more different. So in Canada, people told us about, for example, you know, going to the mall to buy a scarf for their mom, very familiar kinds of spending experiences for most of us. Now, there were some experiences like that people described in Uganda, but there were also really striking experiences like, you know, someone explaining that they'd spend a certain amount of money to buy medication to help save a neighbor who was dying from malaria. I mean, just very different experiences that we don't see so much in our Canadian and American samples that we usually study. And so I have to just be honest with you, when I was reading through these surveys when I was in Africa collecting this data, I thought, okay, there's no way we're going to see the same effects that we saw in Canada here in Uganda. And so when all the data was punched in, I was really quite startled to discover that, in fact, even in Uganda, where many of our participants were struggling to meet their own basic needs, we saw that people experienced more of a kind of happiness bang for their buck when they thought about a time that they spent the money on somebody else rather than on themselves.
It's so amazing. It's so similar. It's so, so amazing. And it really, I look for that, for studies, for there to be a body of work and be cross-cultural. And so this is really good science. And I wanted to say that about your entire book. And I am talking with Dr. Elizabeth Dunn. Her book, co-authored with Dr. Michael Norton, is Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. It's 157 pages. It's great. I love short, really good books. It's very entertaining. So I want to get to a little more of the stuff you talk about. One important thing, actually, is that being forced into giving charity seems to suck the joy out of it, that we have to want to do it really, and as the saying goes, from the heart, or it's not going to make us happier.
Mm-hmm. When we feel like, you know, we just did something nice because we had to, because we were forced to, that doesn't deliver much of an emotional payoff. Now, you know, in some of our experiments, it's interesting because we actually give people money and tell them they have to spend it on somebody else. But we always give them some latitude in terms of how exactly they do that. So, you know, people have a lot of free will in terms of how they go about helping somebody else. In contrast, I think, you know, when some of us get cornered by a representative of a particular charity on the street, you know, we can feel kind of like forced to give just to get out of the situation. And I think, you know, that is not a giving situation that's likely to foster a lot of happiness. Instead, the kinds of giving situations that tend to foster happiness are those where we really feel like we seek out the opportunity to give and where we can really see the impact that our generosity is making.
Oh, yeah, I liked where you talked about that. It has to have a concrete impact. It can't just be mail a check to somebody. It's going to have a lower impact than if you help someone and they're there and they're happier. So I want to move on. You have this great chapter, big problem people have with, you know, we have credit cards, and you talk about pay now, consume later as a way to be happier. With credit cards, you know, we pay later, consume now. And so with payment pushed into the indefinite future, what happens? Where do we derive more happiness from our spending?
Well, no matter what, when we spend money, especially when we have to kind of pay a little more than we might like, say fork over $5 for a latte or pay $30,000 for a new car, paying that amount, paying a high price, triggers a kind of experience of pain that's actually, neuroscientists have found this experience of pain is remarkably similar to real stub-your-toe style physical pain. So we're going to experience that pain of paying whether we pay now or pay later. But if we pay now, pay up front before we say, you know, if you're going to go on vacation in October and you pay for it right now, it does hurt to pay, but you get that payment out of the way so that when you're actually off on vacation, you know, enjoying margaritas on the beach, you can enjoy those margaritas as though they were free because you paid for that vacation far in advance. So paying up front can kind of free us to enjoy the experience later.
And you also talk about how uncertainty is really fun for us and intensifies things. And one story from my life that I just love, so these chocolate bars, sometimes I don't. My boyfriend has been buying the food because I haven't left my house for 4 months. And he would hide chocolate bars. I have a terrible memory. He'd hide chocolate bars in my house. And then at some moment when I was having a rotten day, we'd talk on the phone, and he'd say, chocolate. He'd say, where? And I'd get up on a stool, and I have to go get it. And that was so exciting to me, so much more exciting than if he had given me a chocolate bar. I knew it was there. I put it in my thing. I could eat it when I wanted. So talk about that uncertainty intensifying things for us.
Yeah, I think most of us who have children to some extent recognize that uncertainty amplifies pleasurable experiences. So I can remember as a child seeing, you know, all those Christmas presents all wrapped up under the tree. There's just something about the unknown disguised in, you know, gift wrap and bows that kind of seems more exciting than whatever could possibly be within those boxes. So once all the gifts are unwrapped, they're just not quite as pleasurable as when they're, you know, sitting there all wrapped up, invisible and secret in terms of their contents. And so I think, you know, when a child says, hey, can I go ahead and open my presents even though it's, you know, Christmas is 5 days away, we know the right answer is no, you have to wait. And we know that waiting will actually provide an enjoyable source of pleasure and anticipation. I think we forget sometimes to apply that principle to ourselves, to build in some uncertainty to our lives. And I love that example with your boyfriend. I think it's something nice that romantic partners can do for each other, is to build in this kind of uncertainty that then amplifies these pleasurable experiences.
Yeah, it's so nice. And so I think a thing that people should highlight there that you write about in your book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, I'm talking with Dr. Elizabeth Dunn. You talk about the benefits to delay, that delay provides a valuable opportunity to draw out the pleasure beyond the experience itself. So it sort of amps it up. And you talk about the space flights, like the 6-minute galactic space flight. So somebody's going to go up there for 6 minutes, but they spend all this time anticipating it, and that really adds to it in an incredible way.
Exactly. So Marcia Fiamengo, the future astronaut who we discussed at the beginning of the interview, has not yet gone into space, but having paid her deposit quite a while ago for her ticket, she's already experienced a great deal of pleasure in the form of anticipation. She has, for example, Virgin Galactic organizes these meetups with these astronauts so that these future space travelers get to meet one another. And they've actually created a real sense of community, and they've done things like raising funds for science education together. So having a pleasurable experience that lies in the future can be something that really generates a lot of pleasure. It's funny, my friends and I were working on organizing a New Year's Eve trip for this coming year. And in the end, it turns out the trip isn't going to be able to happen due to some logistical problems. But we had so much fun planning it. Like, we would get together and have these dinners and kind of talk about all the wonderful places we could go together. And even though that trip will never actually happen, it ended up providing us a lot of pleasure just in the form of kind of imagination. Our minds can go all kinds of places that can provide us with a lot of joy, whether or not those experiences ever end up happening.
Wow, I just love that. I have been talking with Dr. Elizabeth Dunn. She's co-author with Dr. Michael Norton of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. We're almost out of time. I just want to talk about the principles you gave for happier spending. Buy experiences, make it a treat, buy time, pay now, and consume later, and invest in others. These are all such great, great tips, and your book is filled with them, but I wanted to ask you just to leave us with a final bit of advice on how to make money make us happier.
You know, I think the biggest thing is just pausing to ask ourselves the question. We get so ingrained in our habits that we find ourselves, you know, forking over money, $5 for a latte or something, just because that's what we did yesterday. So my advice to people going out tomorrow would be, before you reach for yourself, for your wallet, ask yourself, is this happy money?
That's great, great advice. Thank you so, so much. This has just been a wonderful show. And really, everyone, I do recommend her book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Thank you again.
Yeah.